yesteryear.
Howdy, folks.
Yes, it is your old friend Singing Sam. So let's just settle back and reminisce a bit. What do you say, huh?
With a nostalgic nod toward the Atwater Kent, we now present Same Time, Same Station, a chronicle of broadcasting's first half century.
Return with us now to those whirling days of yesteryear.
Tonight, we continue our chat with Marvin Miller. We left Mr. Miller firmly established as one of Chicago's top announcers and actors.
But anyhow, I started out playing roles on those shows and wound up announcing two of them. Guiding Light was one, and I can't remember the name of this other one. Something about a woman. I mean, the word woman was in the title. Anyhow, it doesn't matter, really. But I did play a number of roles on them. In The Right to Happiness, I played the voice of everybody's conscience, which was a device that they used again and again and again. And I also played a role on Guiding Light called Ellis Smith, Mr. Nobody from Nowhere. Would you like to hear a little sample of a typical soap opera soliloquy from those days? I've got one here.
Now, The Guiding Light. A man sits before a portrait where the features of a beautiful girl are easily discernible. A man wearing thick-lensed glasses. A man whose eyes wander from the easel to seemingly speculate on thoughts within himself. Although the slowly descending sun paints the studio in mystical gold-red colors, the electric lights are turned on full. Ellis Smith, a sober expression on his haggard face, speaks aloud, although no one is in the room to hear him. Speaks aloud in an almost hopeless way.
God help me. I must finish this portrait of Nancy, the picture of my daughter, before I go completely blind. God help me, I said. Yes. It is only natural for us, for any of us, to turn to someone higher when things look blackest. Blackest. Darkness blotting out the daylight. Am I afraid? Do I dread it so very much? Of course I do. What man wouldn't? Not to see again, not to be able to look at faces, to study them, to paint them. Not to be able to see the stars, the moon, the birds, the trees, the flowers, all manner of living things. To be shut off in a world of my own fancy. A world of my own fancy. Perhaps I'm being punished because I've always lived in a world of my own fancy. Because I've constantly refused to see things as they really are. I refused to recognize Myrna's love for me. I turned away from it. I transformed it into hate. A hate which led her to bring a daughter, whom I didn't know existed, into contact with me. A hate which took its revenge by teaching that lovely, innocent girl to regard me with repulsion. Yes, life from which I unconsciously tried to escape is caught up with me. Has brought me face to face with facts. A few moments ago, I asked myself, am I afraid? Do I dread my ultimate blindness? I should be able to answer that. It's only been a little over 2 years ago that I lost my sight before. Lost it in trying to save a life. Oh, how well I remember that night.
I can't get out! Oh,
out of here. Help! Help!
Rebecca!
Someone's coming. Who is it? Who is it?
The door is locked. Open your door.
I can't.
You must.
No. No. You must. Save yourself.
Rebecca. Rebecca, where are you?
Rebecca. Never mind me, Ellen.
I've got to get her out somewhere.
Save yourself. Save yourself.
Just take it easy now. Everything's going to be all right. Don't talk. Put this wet towel over you.
They're blazing. I can't get through.
I said don't try to talk. We'll get through.
Frederica. Oh, thank God. Smith, is she all right?
I think so. She needs air.
Oh.
Here. Someone take her.
Smith.
Yes?
Are you all right? Are you all right?
I don't know. I don't know.
Good heavens. I can't see.
Yes, how well I remember that night. How well I remember the perpetual night which followed. The perpetual night when I seemed to wander endlessly in a vast sea of darkness. At first, I found it almost impossible to realize what had happened to me. At first, I found myself thinking...
Yes, that was an air check, an off-the-air recording. Since there was so much soliloquy in that particular one, I paid to have a local air checker record it for me. And that was in 1941. I've got another, 42 actually. I've got one here from 41 that is probably the big warm spot in my heart so far as the soap opera days are concerned. And that was The Romance of Helen Trent. I created the role of the guy that went through the rest of her life as her great love and whom she just never got around to marrying. The name of the role was Gil Whitney, and I'm sure anybody still extant who remembers that show will recall Gil Whitney. There's a very funny thing about that. People really were bound up in radio in those days, and they had a peculiar dichotomous imagery. They understood that they were shows on radio and that they were played by actors, but at the same time, they believed them. And to the, you know, that they really were taking place. This dual identity thing was something they could accept. I have a letter in my files to this day. I don't have it handy here, but I still have it. It's so funny as it is, from a little old lady who, by chance, lived in a Chicago suburb, although that show covered the full network. And she wrote me a letter telling me, as Gil Whitney, although she addressed it to Marvin Miller, telling me as Gil Whitney the foul plots being hatched by my ex-sister-in-law. See, Gil was a widower, and his dead wife's younger sister had always had her cap set for Gil. And when he fell in love with Helen Trent, this was a great blow to her ego, so she did everything she could to undermine their relationship and fomented all sorts of phony plots and so forth to separate them, and it resulted in many misunderstandings and spats and so forth. So this little old lady sat down to recap the plot for the last 6 months and expose my villainous sister-in-law for the cheat that she was. It went into great detail, telling me all about it and exposing certain misunderstandings I had had, supposedly, with Helen, and said, now, I want you to pay attention to this. I've written Helen a half a dozen times, for instance, when she had that relationship with so-and-so, and I warned her, I wrote to her, and said this man was a crook and was not honest, and she didn't even give me the courtesy of a reply, let alone believe me. You see what happened? She lost her business. So you pay attention to me. You actually listen to what I'm telling you because it's all true. And then she suddenly broke and said, you know, there's one thing I cannot understand about you radio people. You're not on the show every day. And you certainly must have a radio in your car. Well, when you're not on the show, why don't you tune in the radio in your car or at home and find out what's going on behind your back? Isn't that interesting? She could actually accept this as something that was possible. The only kind of people imaginable who could really understand their own destiny by listening to themselves on the air. One of the problems that did arise in the soap opera days was the business of replacing a running role from time to time, getting a little ahead in time. This happened in the case of One Man's Family when Reggie, I'm giving him the name he had in another show, which was I Love a Mystery. It was an English actor who was married to one of the original Barber family in One Man's Family. He died, and he was sent to Europe in the script very suddenly and never came back. And for many years, letters would come in from him and would be read, but the character never appeared again. He was never recast. In most cases, however, they were recast. As a matter of fact, this role of Gil Whitney that I mentioned was actually, there was a Gil Whitney in the show earlier, played by somebody else, and he was a much older man, a producer, as I recall, who had just a few shows with Helen, but he dropped out for over a year. And when he was brought back, they used the name and the fact that he had appeared before only to make it obvious that she'd already met him. You know, he was somebody that she knew as a slight friend. I mean, there was a slightly friendly relationship between them. In that case, recasting it was no problem, and that's when I took it over, and actually the relationship developed into a romance. I'd love to play you the first scene from Helen Trent where Gil actually made love to Helen. And incidentally, the gal playing this was the original Helen Trent, Virginia Clark. It was played by three girls. They couldn't write Helen out of the script for as much as a day. Betty Ruth Smith took it over. And then when they moved the show to New York after I came out to the coast here, then they recast the whole show in New York. And from that time on, Helen Trent was played by Julie Stevens, and Gil Whitney was played by David Gothard, who, to the best of my knowledge, is in Hollywood now as an actor, occasionally doing pictures and television. But getting back to the matter at hand, let's hear this love scene from Helen Trent.
Again, the romance of Helen Trent. Helen has almost given up hope of Gil Whitney's ever caring for her deeply again. For much too long a time, she couldn't decide whether she loved Gil or not. When at last she did make up her mind, Gil was so weary of their prolonged quarreling and separation, he told her he intended to put her entirely out of his mind and heart. And he tried to. For months, he has seldom seen Helen. One time, he was engaged to Martha Carvel, who assisted him in his confidential government work. Lately, he's been courting Barbara Randall, one of the prettiest young stars in pictures. But last night, Gil finally admitted to himself that he's helpless against his enduring love for Helen. And now, at 5 o'clock of the following day, he has come to her office at Parafilm Studios to tell her so. It's a hot afternoon in Hollywood. The sun beats pitilessly against the Venetian blinds by Helen's drawing board. Gil's fresh white linen suit looks cool, but he mops his damp forehead with his handkerchief. Helen sits behind her desk watching him.
It certainly wasn't very flattering to me, Gil, to have your secretary call and say you'd be here to take me to dinner. When did you start having her make your dates for you?
Today, and for a very special reason.
Well, it would have to be a good one.
It is a good one. I've got something to tell you, Helen, and I didn't want to say it over the phone. I want to say it with my arms around you. Will you get up out of your chair and walk over here, please? I can't put my arms around you with a desk between us.
Gil, what? What suddenly changed you so?
Nothing, darling. Except I've decided to stop fighting you. I can't win.
You call me darling.
Why not? You are my darling. Will you stop sitting there behind that desk?
Gil, are you fooling me? Don't say those things if you don't mean them.
I don't see anything for me to do to convince you, but to lean across this desk and kiss you.
Oh, Gil. You seem as though you don't think we're wrong for each other anymore.
Wrong or right, we belong together. Come here to me.
Why?
Put your arms around me.
Gil, do you mean this?
This is only the beginning. Look out, my darling. You're about to be kissed 1,000 times.
You're fooling me. In a minute you're going to change and say you're only fooling me.
No, I'm not fooling, Helen. I love you. I never have stopped loving you, and I never will.
Gil, is this true? Is it really and truly true? Is it happening?
Of course it is. Maybe I shouldn't have taken you so much by surprise this way.
I'm afraid it isn't happening at all. It's been so hot today, and maybe I fainted, and I'm having hallucinations.
Oh, nonsense.
Maybe an alarm clock will ring in a second. I won't be here at my office at all.
No alarm clock.
I've got to be sure. I've got to know. I'll look and see if Ginger's outside in her typewriter.
She was when I came in.
Ginger. Oh, there you are. No, never mind. I just wondered if you'd gone home.
Are you convinced now?
Not quite. Things this wonderful just don't happen, Gil. Except in dreams. Suppose I'm asleep.
You poor darling. I really have given you a shock, haven't I?
I'll pick up the phone and see if it answers. Oh, excuse me, operator. No, never mind.
You see, what did I tell you?
Oh, Gil. Gil, this is what I've waited for. I've prayed and hoped and worked and longed for. Now it's here. This is you.
You're going to cry so much you'll make me feel worse than I do now.
This is you. This is you.
Why don't you get your things and we'll be on our way, hmm? We've got so much to talk about, a nice long evening ahead of us to talk in. And we've got to have dinner, too. Would you rather talk first or eat first?
I don't care now if I never eat again in my whole life.
Well, I do. Let's go over to the Terrace Club and have an early dinner before the place gets crowded.
No. No, let's don't go to a public place. I want to be near you. I don't even want to sit across the table from you. I want to be near you.
Whatever you say.
I want to be able to reach out and touch you all the time. I never, never want to be so far from you again that I can't touch you or hear your voice.
Nor I.
I know what let's do.
What?
Is the refrigerator turned on at your house in the valley?
Mm-hmm.
Let's go out there where it's cool and where we can be alone. Where we can... Couldn't we stop by a delicatessen and buy some sandwiches or something and take them out to your place?
Sure, that's a great idea. Nothing in my pantry but some coffee.
Oh, we can have some iced coffee and sandwiches and maybe chicken salad or something.
And strawberries out of my garden. Oh, it's wonderful. Grab your hat and let's get out of here. Darling, will you stop crying and be half as happy as I am? You know, blow hard. I've got to get you straightened out.
Oh, Gil. The biggest moment of my life. The very biggest moment of my whole life. It would have to come at the end of a hot, busy day with no wave in my hair and my nails need doing. And I always look awful with my eyes swollen from crying.
You look beautiful to me. You always do. Are you ready to go?
Will we get the bus?
Bus, heck. We'll fly on a cloud.
Come on. Well, we rigged up a pretty good dinner, didn't we?
Ideal for a hot night.
Let's just sit here on the top step and watch the twilight.
All right. Your garden looks lovely. You must have been doing a lot of work on it.
Yes, I have. From now on, it's your garden too, darling, which means you have to weed half of it.
I don't mind.
Here, sit close to me. Don't go away.
No danger.
Look at the fireflies and the oleander bushes.
Gil, I have a mad desire. I want to go telephone everybody. Agatha and Alice, Jeannie, everybody. I want to tell them about you and me. Oh, and by the way, when will we be married?
Maybe I should have told you before, Helen. There's a hitch in all this.
A hitch?
I'm not going to ask you to marry me.
What?
What I said. I'm not going to ask you to marry me.
Helen searched Gil's face suddenly in the dark light of early evening. For a moment, she thought surely he was fooling. She waited for him to say something. He said nothing more and looked away. Be sure not to miss the continuation of this scene in Monday's important chapter of The Romance of Helen Trent.
It's an interesting footnote to my work as Gil Whitney on Helen Trent. Incidentally, the funniest thing about Helen Trent, of course, is that the show always opened up with the announcer saying that this was the program that proved that a woman could still find romance after 35. Well, since the show began with that premise, and it had been on the air for quite a few years before I ever joined it, and I think its full longevity was something like 26 or 27 or 28 years. If you stop and realize that the last Helen Trent show, which I wasn't on, which Davy Gothard played Gil Whitney in, left Gil out on the balcony banging on the door, begging Helen to let him in so that he could run away with her and get married, and she didn't. You can understand why a woman after 35 couldn't find romance. 35 plus 27? It was a funny thing about soap operas, so far as the actor's attitude was concerned, I suppose. We knew that they were gimmicked. We used to laugh at the Erna Phillips shows because she wrote the shortest scripts of any of the great soap opera writers. Most of her scripts were only about 4 or 5 pages long. And she loved soliloquies, as we evidenced by our sample of the earlier show today. But we used to say that the pauses in an Erna Phillips show were big enough to drive a truck through. She loved the dramatic pause. And of course, since the secret of the appeal of radio to the audience was always that the audience had to develop its own mental images, sometimes a pause could truly be pregnant in the true meaning of the phrase, because it was up to the auditor to figure out just what was going on during one of those pauses. But one of the things that we did in a pregnant pause on Helen Trent that I'll never forget, the first time, and I think it may have been the one that we just played, that Gil really smacked Helen. He really gave her a soulful embrace and kiss. I asked the director if it was all right with him if we worked on the same side of the mic, because I felt that there was an intimacy that could be set up there that would show in our voices. And he said he didn't object if Virginia didn't. It was Virginia Clark. So I said, "Do you mind, Jenny?" And she said, "No, I think it would be great." Kind of giggling, you know. So we put up a music stand. It was always customary to hold your script in your hand, very carefully extracting a staple or clip so that it didn't rattle when you turned a page. You learned very early how to smooth one page out over the other without making the slightest bit of rustle noise. Because a piece of rattling paper on the microphone can sound kind of like a forest fire. I just use that as a prop. I don't want our audience to think that I'm actually reading all I'm saying. But anyhow, when the time came for the kiss, I kissed her. I had my arm around her, of course, to get the intimate feeling. When the kiss came, I kissed her. It was a very nice, long leg. She's a very attractive girl, anyhow. Shucks, I'm no fool. And as we separated, she looked at me with wide eyes and a funny little smile on her lips, you know, and she didn't break and I didn't break. It was legitimate. You know, it's the way you'd play it if you were doing it visually as well as audibly. And from that time on, if there was a kiss between Gil and Helen while I was playing the part, Helen got kissed. I can't talk about Davy Gothard. I don't know how he handled it. But so much for realism in soap operas. We had a feeling of extended action even though we were inactive. It was a funny thing. People who were in those old soap operas, and in all radio as a matter of fact, got to be great sight readers because you had a minimum of rehearsal. For instance, the soap operas very seldom got over over an hour of rehearsal. And Helen Trent, the chap who directed it for most of the years I was on it, Blair Walliser, and then later Les Mitchell did it. Les was a much more workmanlike director. Blair had so many other shows to worry about. He wrote some, he directed some, that he used to come in about 15 minutes before the show went on the air. And all he really rehearsed were the sound cues, just to be sure if there were any door openings or traffic sounds that the sound man knew when the cue came and the engineer was prepared for them. And we did it pretty cold. There was a great feeling of spontaneity about it that might have been good. I always have felt that shows can be over-rehearsed, particularly when you don't have to worry about line memorization. And in these cases, I see no reason for going over them too many times. Those first readings are often beautiful readings. So that type of feeling, you know, could be very good, but you couldn't move too far from the mic or you lost the picture. Therefore, when people would go into movies from radio, they were the best sight readers in the world. They could read a script and make more sense out of it than anybody else ever could. But when it came to movement, they were rooted. As a matter of fact, there's a wonderful story they tell about Hugh Marlowe, who's an old friend of mine. For many years, he played Ellery Queen on radio in New York. When he came out and got into pictures, one of the first criticisms of him by a director was, "You're a great actor as long as you're talking." Because as soon as he read a line, he was animated. But the moment he stopped and waited for the other line, he froze, because that's what you do in radio. You have a script in your hand, you see. How could you do anything with it? But anyhow, I guess I was sort of a pioneer in the romantic field so far as Helen and I were concerned.
The makers of Campana products present the First Night of Program, a copyrighted feature, coast to coast.
Of course, although Chicago will always be immortal as the hometown for soap opera, it should not be overlooked that a lot of other shows, a half-hour or even hour-long dramatic show, also emanated from the Windy City. New York was always thought of as the big place for comedy shows and radio shows on their own merit, that is, dramatic radio shows and even musical shows. Hollywood was first and foremost and only the place for shows which used motion picture people. And in those days, there was much less overlapping between stage people and movie people and radio people. Movie people usually couldn't go on the stage very successfully and were terrible when it came to radio. On the other hand, theater people were terrible when it came to movies because they couldn't learn to act backwards. I mean, start a story in the middle and learn their lines in a hurry without any rehearsal. And although they very often were okay when it came to radio, they were always projecting like mad. Today you have to be almost interchangeable. You have to know how to handle all the media because you never can tell when you're going to turn up in one of them. At least that's been my own experience. But on the other hand, a lot of the dramatic shows were pretty serious when they were done in Chicago. One of them that was kind of gimmicky but will remain in the memories of many, many people was First Nighter. I was the announcer on First Nighter for about 2 years, in fact, until I left Chicago in 44. And I also played Mr. First Nighter himself for a year. Brett Morrison was the First Nighter for most of the years that it was on. I, however, did it for the 1 year, and in the other years had been the announcer. But other than that, I also was one of the regular company to play supporting roles. And there should be a very clear distinction made here. Mr. First Nighter was the voice of a device. He was not the announcer. He was not the star. He was the man who got out of the limousine, for whom the doorman opened the door, and who then went past the ticket taker and was saluted and took his place in the number one box and told about that night story and said the curtain was going up, and when the curtain came down on the first act, you heard the call boy, and Mr. First Nighter said, "And the curtain falls on the first act of such and such and such and such, brought to you by the Campana Company, makers of Italian Bomb. Now, as we stroll out toward the street for our cigarette," which you could mention, you know, in those days.
Theater time and a new play scheduled for the Little Theater off Times Square. An opening night on the Great White Way is the kind of gala event that never fails to attract people from far and near. Sightseers will crowd the sidewalks of the theater, and streams of automobiles and taxicabs will give the traffic officers a strenuous evening. So let's get started early. We want to be in our seats on time. Now, here's my cab. All right, driver, up Broadway. Well, here we are.
Have your tickets ready, please. Have your tickets ready, please.
Evening, Mr. First Nighter. Curtain in 2 minutes. Thank you. We'll go right in. Let's go for our theater program.
Don Ameche was the first star of the show, not first Mr. First Nighter. Francis X. Bushman was on the show in its early years, and I think he was the Mr. First Nighter before Brett was. Barbara Luddy, of course, played it over the years, many, many, many years, and there was somebody before her who played with Don Ameche. And I'm bad at this name. I know it when I heard it. First name started with an M. Like Millicent or something of that sort, Madeline. Anyhow, after Don Ameche got his big picture contract, Les Tremaine stepped in. And it was Les who did it all the years that I was in Chicago. And Les is still one of my very dear friends. Strangely enough, when the show moved out here, at the very end of radio days, Olin Soule picked up the lead. And at that time, Michael Rye became Mr. First Nighter. And Mike also, of course, comes from Chicago radio. As I say, I played quite a few supporting roles on it, and particularly some dog heavies. Maybe you'd like a sample of it.
Ready for the last act, and there goes the curtain.
I'm kind of sorry I'm missing tonight's First Nighter play. I bet it's been exciting.
6 minutes and 20 seconds to go. That's your call, Sam. Take it.
Hello? Is this the president of the network? Good. This is Ed Stamm, an engineer at KMY. Oh, you don't know me, but after tonight, you'll never forget me. Look, Mr. President, I have some nitroglycerin planted in the control room here at KM Watt. Nitroglycerin. As soon as this program ends and the line is reversed, KM Watt will be blown clear off the map. This is no joke. I want you to tell him to repeat the first nighter program. I didn't hear it anyway. Well, now, sir, if you don't believe me, here's Bob Malcolm. Bob, you tell him.
Hello? Yes, this is Bob Malcolm. No, sir, this is on the level. I don't care. You have to keep that program going till we can remove the explosive. They've been on the air 11 years. Dig out all the old plays and do them from the beginning. I'm dead serious. I mean, I'm serious, and I will be dead. What do you mean you're depending on me? You're the president. You think of something. I don't want a raise. We thought of calling the police.
I got to get a hat, Ben.
Let me out, sir.
Sit down. You won't be sick long.
No, it is not a gag. Now, listen to me. Hello. Hello.
Did he hang up?
Yeah. He wouldn't believe it. Said it couldn't happen.
He'll find out.
Ed, think a minute. Even if you got your wish, if they kept this program going, think what confusion it would cause.
Bob's right, Ed. Think of the programs that follow First Nighter. You wouldn't want them cut off the air, would you? Think of the disappointed listeners.
Yeah, that's right.
Ed, in that control board in there are 10 miles of wires. You did that wiring. It's a job no other engineer in the world could have done. That'll all be ruined if the stuff explodes.
Yeah, I didn't think of that.
You're clever, Stan. You can think of some way of stopping that explosion. Pull the wires.
No, it'd take 15 minutes to get to the wires. We only have 3 minutes and 50 seconds.
Well, can you reach down the hole and get the bottle?
No, the hole's just wide enough for the bottle. Gee, I don't want my control board blown up.
I know. There's a cork in the bottle, isn't there?
Yeah.
Use a spindle. Stick it in the cork and lift the bottle up.
Yeah, I could do that.
Come on.
I'll just go along if you don't mind. I thought you'd support.
There should be a spindle in here somewhere.
How much time?
3 minutes and 20 seconds.
Yes, there isn't any.
Oh,
yeah, here it is.
Good. Hurry up.
Maybe it isn't long enough. Yeah, I guess it is.
Will it reach the cork?
I believe I've got it.
Careful when you lift it out.
Here it comes.
Yeah.
Oh, I just got the cork. The bottle's still in there.
Oh, Bob.
That's too bad.
Never mind. What else can you try, Stan? Is there some instrument that will clamp on the bottle? Think, Stan, think.
Trying to think. Oh, there's Dr. Eberhard. I'm sorry, Doctor. I didn't mean to hurt anybody.
Good. You've cracked. That suppressed desire is all gone, isn't it? You'll be all right now, sir.
You mean it? You mean I'm not crazy anymore?
Not anymore. A little less than you be yourself again. There must have been some shock.
Listen, both of you. That's wonderful. But that nitro is still in the control board. In just 2.5 minutes, it'll explode.
Explode? Why don't you stop it?
I'm trying to. I can't seem to think how. I feel so tired. My mind won't work.
If there is danger of an explosion, the people in the building should be warned. I'll go tell them.
Go ahead.
We'd all better leave. There's only 2 minutes and 15 seconds left.
I'm not going. I caused all this. If only I could think of something.
Now, take it easy, Ed. I believe you can do it. I'm going to stay, too. Now, you have 2 minutes. Don't get excited. Just stop and think.
Wait. There is something at my work.
Ed. What is it?
What?
I have some cleaning fluid here. I could pour it in the bottle with the nitroglycerin. That would change the chemical proportions. Then perhaps there won't be an explosive any longer. Give me that bottle.
Are you sure the chemicals will mix?
Well, they should. Of course, there's no telling what we'll have, but it shouldn't be nitro.
Program's about over.
There. That ought to do it. Are you getting the announce booth for your station break, Bob?
But is it going to explode or isn't it?
I don't know. The danger will come on the cue. When the announcer says, "This is the Columbia so-and-so." If it doesn't explode, then it never will.
It's up to you, Sam. Shall we take a chance?
I think so. But I may still be crazy.
No, I think you're all right now. I'll stick. But Ruth...
I won't leave without you. You proposed to me. Till death do us part. I'll stick, too.
Good luck.
Thanks. Same to you.
Bob... You ought to get your friend to write this up and send it to the First Nighter.
No. It's too unbelievable. People would think he made it all up, unless...
Unless what?
Well, they'll believe it all right if, at 59:30, we're all blown to blazes.
The curtain falls on the 554th performance of Little Theater off Times Square. Thank you.
drove out of the theater and into the street.
And Mr. Chris Snyder.
Thank you.
Good night.
Some of the other shows I did in Chicago, which I felt very warmly about, one of them was the series on WGN known as the Chicago Theater of the Air. This was a Saturday night show devoted to musical comedy, and occasionally it got so serious it even went into grand opera. It had a resident lady soprano, Marion Clare, who happened to be married to the conductor of the WGN Symphony Orchestra. Mr. Weber. They were a lovely couple, and Mr. Weber was a very fine conductor. There was... Marion had had a pretty good career in musical comedy, but it might have simply been luck that people called her the Clarion Mare. Or it may have been because she didn't occasionally hit the note she was aiming at. But the technique was they used very good supporting singers for Miss Clare, who were top names. I remember Igor Gorin was one of their favorites, and Thomas L. Thomas, and even John Charles Thomas in his day. Richard Tucker, of course, who's still a big name at the Met to this very day. Robert Weedy. I wish I could begin to think of some of the people. You'd know them all. Kenny Baker. Some musical comedy, but many of them very serious singers from the operatic side would do these roles. And then they would double the lines. They were done by Chicago radio actors. Well, if it was a baritone role, I very often did the acting lead. I remember doing Schubert for Blossom Time. As Igor Gorin's voice. I tried to retain a little bit of his accent, which, of course, was Russian, and Schubert was Viennese. These were great shows. They were done with a flair, and one of the things that Bill used to love to do was costume them. Can you imagine costuming shows for radio? Well, we did the Mikado. We dressed in full Japanese regalia for radio! But we had a big studio audience, and I guess it gave it a flavor. One of the wonderful things, I already indicated this earlier, about Colonel McCormick, and I say wonderful rather sardonically, was that, as I mentioned, we could never get him to actually tell us how long the speech would be. And I'll never forget one night, Colonel McCormick was host to a convention of American newspapermen, and he was giving him a long talk before he started his speech on the air. And all of a sudden, it was airtime. And Bill rushed out on the stage and said, Colonel McCormick, we're just about ready to go on the air.
Well, make them wait. I'm going to talk to these gentlemen. They're my guests.
So they put an organ fill on the network for about 3 minutes until he finished making his little speech to the guests in the studio audience, and then they started the show on the Mutual Network. The subject of the Colonel's talks at the beginning of each show were also a matter of some interest because he was a great student of the Civil War, and all he talked about were great battles of the Civil War. Had nothing to do with the day's current events, had nothing to do with WGN or running a newspaper or anything else, or certainly nothing to do with the story that night. There were always a resume of some great incident in the Civil War. We did one other show on the Chicago Theater of the Air. I was on the thing through many directors, as a matter of fact, during the 5 years I was there. But we did one other show, which was Peer Gynt. And that was quite a show. That was not vocalized, of course. It was done with Grieg's music, which was mood-setting, of course, and I played Peer Gynt. If I find a little spot of that, I might let you hear a little sample of that, too.
Morning. Morning on the desert of Arabia. Morning in the fields of Carolina. Morning past the Sphinx at Gizeh. Morning along the coast of Malabar. Morning in Norwegian forests. Morning at the farmhouse of Osa Gynt, widow of Jan Gynt, mother of Peer Gynt.
Oh, like that I shot him, Mother dear.
Here, you lie. There isn't a word of truth in it.
Ah, such a buck, so sleek and fat. You, I'm sure, have ne'er set eyes on.
Certainly I haven't. Oh, good heavens.
Bang, 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 like that I fired. And clean he dropped upon the hillside. But the instant that he fell, I sat firm astride his back.
Here, I don't believe
I gripped him by the left ear tightly. And it almost sunk my knife blade in his neck behind his skull, when behold, the brute screamed wildly.
Hair.
He sprang upon his feet like lightning, and with a back cast of his head from my fist made knife and sheath fly, pinned me tightly by the thigh, jammed his horns against my legs, clenched me like a pair of tongs.
Don't you blush before your mother.
And away with me he went. Away forthwith, away he flew, right along the canyon edge.
Oh, Lord help us.
Have you ever seen the canyon edge? Nigh on 4 miles long it stretches, sharp before you like a scythe. Down are glaciers, landslips, scars, down the toppling gray moraines. You can see both right and left, straight into the streams that slumber black and sluggish, more than 700 fathoms deep below you.
Whee! Here will you stop?
Right along the canyon edge we clove our passage through the air. Never rode I such a colt. All at once, a great cock eagle, flapping, cackling, terrified, rose from the crack where he lay hidden at the buck's feet on the edge. Then the buck shied half around, leaped sky high, and down we plunged, both of us, into the depths. Ah! There we lay then, floating, splashing. But at last we made our way somehow to the northern shore. And I ran home to you, Mother.
But the reindeer, Pear? The reindeer?
He's still there for all I know. Catch him and you're welcome to him.
And your neck you haven't broken? Haven't broken both your thighs and your backbone, too, is whole? Oh, dear Lord, what thanks, what praise should be thine who helped my boy. There's a rent, though, in your breeches.
Mm-hmm.
But it's scarce worth talking of when one thinks what dreadful things might have come of such a leap.
Yes. Just lucky, I guess, Mother.
Oh, you devil storyteller. Pear, you're lost and ever will be.
Oh, darling, pretty little mother, don't be cross. Just be happy.
Happy? Think how bitter I must find it. I, a poor, defenseless widow, ever to be put to shame.
Mother, please.
How much have we now remaining from your grandsire's days of glory? Where are now the sacks of gold left behind by Rasmus Gint? Ah, your father lent them wings. Lavished them abroad like sand, buying land in every village, driving round in gilded chariots. Where is all the wealth he wasted at the famous winter banquet, when each guest sent glass and bottles shivering against the wall behind
him? Oh, where's the snow of yesteryear?
Silence, boy, before your mother.
Oh, come now, stop this old wives' talk. Many a time has luck seemed drooping and sprung up as high as ever. All the village shall exalt you. Only wait till I've done something really grand.
You? Would you get so far in sense one day as to do the darning of your breeches for yourself?
I will be a king, a ruler.
Oh, God, comfort me. He's losing all the wits that he ever had.
You wait and see.
Wait. Had you not been steeped forever in your lies and trash and moonshine, you'd be now a bridegroom brave, you that stand here grimed and tattered.
What?
Ingrid Hugstead was fond of you. A golden girl, land entailed on her.
Ingrid? Land and wealth? Come, we'll go a-wooing then.
Oh, the chance is gone. The luck is lost.
What's gone? Speak, Mother.
While off in the Wester Hills, you and Eyre were riding reindeer, here's another's won the girl.
Another's? Ingrid? You mean she...
Aye. She's taking him for husband.
She is she? Well, we'll see.
Spare your pains. They are to be wed tomorrow.
So, this evening I'll be there. Come, I'll bear you to my wedding.
Oh, Pear, put me down.
Come, we'll play it Pear and Reindeer. I'm the reindeer, you are Pear.
Don't drop me. Don't drop
there.
Me.
There. See now, we've reached the shallows.
Pear, your mind has gone full
now. Oh, kiss now for the reindeer, just to thank him for the ride.
Pear, if you see Ingrid now, you'll see her alone.
All right. Alone it shall be then.
Well, we've covered a lot of time in Chicago, haven't we? Imagine all that went in 5 short years, almost to the day. There were many other programs I did back there. There was Knickerbocker Theater, which was another anthology show starring Elliot Lewis. Very similar to First Nighter, and each show was a completely different show with no running characters. It was on once a week and lasted an hour. Very much in the same mode as Lux Radio Theater, really, except that all the shows were originals and not adaptations of famous movies or plays. I've already mentioned the kid shows, but I did regular and long-running parts on things like Backstage Wife, Mary Marlin. Oh, golly, there were so many of them. I started a show back there, a little five-minute show called The Coronet Storyteller. It was sponsored by Coronet Magazine. It was on ABC every evening around 6:55, and ratings were tough on short shows that ended an hour and didn't begin them. We had a fabulous rating. We outrated everybody who was ahead of us, which was kind of odd, seeing that we were in the last 5 minutes of the hour. And when I decided to come out to California in 1944, I brought the show with me and continued it in Hollywood for the next couple of years. There was one other show that I've got to tell you about before we ring down the curtain on Chicago. The Wrigley Company was famous for having shows that never got ratings, with the exception of Mert and Marge. Mert and Marge was one of the all-time famous programs of the era of Amos and Andy. And that was actually before my time. By the time I'd gotten to Chicago, Mert and Marge had already ended. But they did have another one that was quite an interesting show. When we began to arm in advance of any declaration of war, and certainly long before Pearl Harbor, a show named Dear Mom started on the network on CBS. Dear Mom was the story of a boot. The problems of boot camp. And the things that happened to him, you know, shouldn't happen to a boot. It was a weird thing because it started at 5 minutes of the hour and ended, I think it was 15 minutes after the hour. Very peculiar time programming. Johnny Walsh played the lead, who was the awkward rookie of all time. He was the reason for the Dear Mom. Each show started with a letter back to his mother from boot camp. Dear Mom, this week we did so-and-so. And Johnny told the story and how he got into some predicament. Eloise Kummer played the whack. Lou Krugman, who is still very, very active in television, he was the corporal, and I was the tough top kick. Sergeant Monahan. I don't know whether I can dig up a sample of that or not. I might have one around here someplace.
Maybe he's a sergeant. Maybe he's a lieutenant. I saw a miracle yesterday, and it... Foster. Look.
Huh?
I knew it. I knew it.
Well, here comes Homer now.
That Foster is a commissioned officer, a captain.
No, it's Homer, sir. I'd recognize his walk anywhere.
Salute, you fool. Salute. He's got a commission.
Hi, Sergeant Monahan. Homer.
Salute, Foster.
But Homer can't...
Those are captain's bars he's wearing.
Hey, I didn't know non-commissioned officers how to salute us first-class guys. Lucky I noticed, huh? I might have gotten into more trouble.
If the captain pleases, sir, don't make sport of us.
Ah, cut the kidding.
Homer, what are you doing at...
Keep that attention. He didn't give at ease.
Boy, I'm a lucky guy hanging around captains and stuff all the time. But you know something? It ain't going to be as easy as I thought.
The higher the ranks, sir, the more responsibility.
Boy, you're right as mud. Hey, don't you guys know it's raining?
Just sprinkling, sir.
Well, if I was like you and didn't have nothing to do, I'd be inside instead of getting my uniform all ruined.
Homer, what?
Thank you, Captain. We'll find cover.
My uniform be ruined, too, only I put this coat over it.
Homer, who do you think
we'll take your advice, sir. This cover over here. Thank you, sir.
Okay. Boy, it sure is nice to have everybody polite. Well, so long, fellas. Tenting tonight, tenting tonight, tenting.
Hey, Sergeant, I don't get this at all.
It's come, Foster. He's a captain. I knew it would happen. I knew it would, and it has. Another miracle, that's what it was. One day, I'm taking him to the guardhouse for treason. And he's made a private first class, acting as orderly for the colonel's adjutant. The next day, I meet him on the company street, and he's wearing the bars.
Attention!
Sergeant Monahan?
Here, sir.
Sergeant Monahan, I want you to find Private Jones at once.
Yes, sir. Does the captain know what company he's with, sir?
Yours?
Your own platoon. He's my orderly.
But, sir, Private Stubbs was the last orderly I knew.
Private Stubbs was his name before he became orderly.
Before he...
The new book says all orderlies are named Jones. Why don't you keep up with things?
Well, I'm sorry, sir.
No, I can't blame you for that. I didn't know it myself until he told me.
Where is one of those books?
Where is Stubbs? That is Jones. Where is he?
Captain Andrews, sir. I think Captain Stubbs...
Captain Stubbs? Are you crazy, Sergeant? Exactly 1 hour and 45 minutes ago, I sent him to the tailor's with my coat, and he hasn't returned yet.
Beg pardon, Captain. You sent him with what?
My coat to the tailor's. I want it cleaned. He complained to me it was raining.
He wore your coat. That's it. He wore your coat, and he's not a captain.
Sergeant.
Boy, I'll get him this time. I'll get him if it takes my last breath. Impersonating an officer. Insubordination. Treason. Failure to salute. Negligence in a matter of duty. Provoking speeches and gestures. And I'll think of other charges, too. And he'll get 99 years on each count.
But it was a funny show, and then along came Pearl Harbor. And it was canceled overnight. And because then war wasn't anything you laughed at anymore. And the next thing you know, the next week, Wrigley started a half-hour program called The First Line, which was a blow-by-blow account of what happened during the week, but dramatized, of the Navy. It was a show for the Navy, and we all worked on that. They used to use a cast of, they say in pictures, of thousands. Well, radio was of tens, many tens. They used the best actors around, and nobody played more than one part, and there must have been 50 roles on every show. So it was quite a thing. One of the other things that I did in Chicago that I'd love to have a chance to have you hear over this station one of these days, as I mentioned very, very early, I was a temporary reservist in the Coast Guard, and one of the things that meant was writing radio programs and performing them. During the time I was with the Coast Guard, I wrote two epic poems. One was presented shortly after the United States invasion of North Africa during World War II. I wrote the poem, and it was narrated by about four voices. We won't have time for that this time, but I'd love to have you hear it sometime, because who gets a chance to hear your poems read? You know, I mean, not very often. And I do have a recording of that around. Anyhow, the time came then at the early spring of 44 when it was obvious that radio was moving in either direction. Soap opera was going to the East Coast, and big radio was definitely going to the West Coast. So in the middle of April in 44, we decided to make the trek to Hollywood. And we bundled up all our belongings and took a train, because you got bumped off all the planes. And did my last show on a Friday night in Chicago, and my first show on Monday afternoon in Los Angeles in April of 1944. But as we said earlier, that's another story.
Reminiscing, I feel you near. Once more, you're my love of yesteryear.
Next week, Marvin Miller in Hollywood, as our chat with Mr. Miller continues.
Now, you won't want to miss it, so be sure to be with us next week at this same time, same station.